Welcome to episode number 70 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm joined today by Dan Benjamin, founder of this network and original co-founder of this program. Dan, how are you doing today?
Doing good. It's amazing to finally have a chance to come back. You've had such great guests. I'm glad to be among them.
Cool. People have asked, so we should probably get this out of the way. I think the reason you left the show is that I was getting all the women and you were just...
No, that's correct. That's completely true. That's why.
Well, I guess the other reason is that this is a web-focused show and you were more focused on Apple technology and apps and such.
And so, just really, tech in general. And I had been spending less and less time keeping up to date with the web. And I always felt woefully inadequate to talk to the kind of guests that you get on the show, Jeffrey, the kind of guests, these are people who live and breathe the web. They do design, they do responsive design. And people would say, Dan, your website isn't responsive. I'm like, what do you mean? It loads fine. It's response fine. And I realized I was not doing any justice to these guests and to the whole, and so we talked about it and you said, I think I can run with this. And I think I applaud you. I think you've done great and I'm glad to be back to chat with you.
Well, you bring up an interesting point because as you become, I want to talk about the network and the empire that you've built. But it's true that as you, so if you're a person, let's say you're a web developer who starts a show about web development because you're so interested in web development, the longer you do the show, the less time you have to actually do web development.
Right.
So soon you find yourself not understanding what your guests are saying. And this is, you see this with publishers, right? Design publishers start out as designers, become publishers, and lose touch with the design community. I mean, it's certainly a problem, but I want to talk about it first. I want to congratulate you on your success with 5x5. It's a fantastic network. And Eric Meyer said something interesting to me the other day. We were talking about, we have a conference together, a company, and he said, it's not like someone hit us, it's not like the company fairy hit us over the head and said, hey, you've got a company now. And it's true, sometimes people are not of that, but sometimes people can be envious of why is this designer getting so much attention, or why is this app so successful or whatever. And, probably because it was a good idea, the person had it and they worked hard on it. Why is Instapaper popular? Because it was a really good idea and he worked really hard.
No, I totally do. And I think it's, this is a big show that you guys put on. I mean, let's be honest. You're finally bringing it here to Austin, my new hometown, too.
No, I'll be happy to talk about that. But I wanted to, I was using that as a segue to talk about your achievement, 5x5, right? I mean, you started as, you were a freelance web developer, front and back end, and you always were about the content ever since you started blogging back in the 90s. And now you're totally, you're running a network. It's totally about the content. I think that's amazing. So how did you, as we would if you were a normal guest.
I can be normal for 30, 40 minutes.
There we go. So how do you get from, man, this freelance web development is killing me. The client's not paying. We're expecting a baby. I don't know what I'm going to do to, a mogul of the new media.
Well, thanks for that. I'm not sure that is, you're being very complimentary. I appreciate that. It's just like you said, I'd been working, the little background story in this is I was a CTO for a technology company and that was out in San Francisco, and I did that for a year or so, and going back and forth out there all the time, the stress and the pressure of that was a lot. I was running like a remote development team, and I mean, it was really bad. So I took a CTO job at another company that was related to Rails hosting, and I did that for a year or so, and it actually was more stressful. I thought this will be less stressful because I really know Rails, I really like the people I'm working with, and it's a smaller company, it's smaller scale. Oh, it was way more stressful. And
why?
I think what it came down to, there were definitely, I mean, there's always challenges around support, but I think part of the issue there was that Rails at that time, we're talking about, I guess, three, 4 years ago, That and hosting, there were so many things that needed to be just right and so many moving pieces and so many different kinds of customers and the management of that process, especially with the industry changing and the business that I was actually working for, the company I was working for, changing so much that the stress was just really crazy. You know, you're on call all the time. And so, you know, I did have a young kid, maybe not quite 2 years old. And, you know, I wasn't happy there and it just wasn't the right fit for me. It wasn't what I wanted to be. So, of course, you know, the economy is going really horribly. You have a child. Why not quit your job right then and start something new that has absolutely no guarantee of success? But in my mind, if I was doing something that, let me think of how to say this. If my success, if it was directly determined by my own work, which is, I think, the way most freelancers feel, you know, if you don't get up and work, you don't get paid. I felt like even though there was that challenge, at least I felt like I had some kind of influence over what I could get done compared to, you know, being in a situation in a job that just wasn't a good fit for me, that wasn't the right fit, and where I didn't feel like I had, I mean, I don't kid myself that I think I control my own destiny at all, but at least I felt like this way I could, you know, have a little bit of influence over what was going to happen by working really hard and seeing direct results from working really hard. So,
well, we all have our own path, and entrepreneurial types like you and I guess like me, it's hard for us to find our path when we're in a large place where it's not about your individual path. It's about a collective. It's funny, but you know, when you're in client services, you know, as a small studio or as a freelancer, even though you're serving one client and then another, and really it's about their needs, at the same time, you're choosing those clients, you're choosing the kind of, you're building a kind of practice, right? You're working for yourself. So there's something really satisfying about that for a certain kind of personality, which right. I think you and I have. For other people, it's terrifying and it sucks. And, you know, and I don't recommend it for everybody at all. I think a lot of people can thrive in-house. But I was always woefully underemployed in-house. And even when I had a title, I really had no control over the destiny of the company, just right. like you said.
Yeah.
So was it around that time that you started making communities like Corked and Playgrounder? And do you want to talk about that a little?
Oh, no, sure. I can talk about that. I'm trying to remember. I thought you might bring up Corked, and I'm trying to remember the year. And I believe that was 2005, 2006 time frame. And that was a site that Dan Cederholm, you know, very well-known designer who's been on this program, started Dribbble. He and I had built a little site called Corked, and it was a site for wine aficionados, as we called it. But it was really a social network for wine aficionados. So the concept being, you like to drink wine, you want to be kind of casual about it, but you're not like a snob, but you would like very much to share your experiences and see what other people are enjoying and share comments and do reviews and things like that.
Well, that the whole internet, way before there was social media, was always about finding your tribe. I mean, back in the right. dark days of Usenet, you'd be like, I'm a foot fetishist, but only with, you know, people who wear socks and only a certain right. kind of sock. And I've been lonely my whole life, but now there's 1,000 other people and I'm sort of leading this community. I feel special, you know, I mean, right. Social networks, I mean, just kind of grow out of that same thing. It's very human. And, you know, in the old days, your tribe was whoever you were near. And if you were the only person who liked to read in your little working class town, then it sucked to be you. But now, even if you're, you know, lonely and out on the plain somewhere and the only person like you for miles, you can find your tribe. It's weird how many of my friends are web friends and when I meet them, how well we get along when we meet in real life, finally. Right. It's like which you and I still haven't done, I believe.
Yeah. The one chance that we were in close proximity was recently went with South By. And I was unable to get out there at the time that worked for you. We tried. We just did text messages and we didn't do it. But I think we're going to fix that. I think we're going to fix that real soon.
We'll totally fix that. So Corked, what is Cork had an unfortunate denouement, right? Because Gary Vaynerchuk bought it. And then after a while, he, what's the word that they use in it? Like shuttered it, light boxed it, sunset it.
I think that's right. Yeah.
I'm not saying he said that, but that's what they call it in our industry.
Dan Cederholm and I had a number of offers from a bunch of different companies who wanted to acquire it. And neither, you know, Dan was running a successful design business at the time. Right. And I was doing freelance stuff, and the companies that we were talking to, a lot of them, they didn't just want to acquire the site and the data and the users. Of course, they want those things, but they also wanted us. They wanted the whole package. They wanted us to sign in and basically say, well, we'll work with you guys for at least a year, maybe longer. And these
were a Jeff Veen deal. Right. We like MeasureMap. Come work at Google. We like Typekit. Come to Adobe.
Exactly. And that was it. And part of the deal, and to give you an idea who these companies were, I won't say, I mean, they probably wouldn't care now because it's such a long time ago, but these are large, well-known media companies in San Francisco and New York. Then figure it out. You can figure it out.
Yeah, kind of can.
Yeah. Not Google, nothing like that. But, you know, anyway, so these guys, they flew us out to San Francisco. We stayed up in the W and we met with them. And
Yahoo?
No.
It wasn't Yahoo?
No. Well, I don't think they own or did own the companies, but no, it wasn't them directly, no.
Okay.
But so, you know, the point was Dan didn't want to give up his design business. He was having a great time doing it. Right. He loved doing it. I know he does Dribbble now. I don't know if that's like his exclusive thing, but, you know, he really, this was at least not the right time for that. I would have said, sure, I'll work for you guys for a year. But I wasn't planning on a long-term thing. But because of that, we just couldn't make it. And, you know, the deals were okay. They weren't great. So finally, now, and see, this whole thing took off, Corked, way bigger and faster than either Dan or I had ever, you know, I think we had said, if after a month, you know, we have 500 users, this will be a huge success. And we will, you know, we'll get, you know, do something special. This will be great. I mean, yeah, we had like...
way. Most people would feel that way.
We had like 30, 40,000 users within a very short period of time. Now, that doesn't mean active users. It doesn't mean people who are... But our 500 right. number was like 500 people signed up. If we get 500 signups, you know, we had tens of thousands of signups. So it was... But, you know, this was one of the first Rails apps. I was learning a whole lot while I was doing it. And we both realized quickly that we either would need to devote ourselves fully to this, which neither of us were sure we wanted to do, or we had to, you know, we had to sell it to somebody, and it wound up the best overall deal and the deal that we had kind of thought at the time would lead to the greatest longevity and appreciation for the site was with Gary, and that didn't happen.
Well, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, Gary Vaynerchuk is, you know, he's really committed to stuff, and, you know, he's got a great personality, and he loves wine. It kind of, he already had a wine empire, kind of made sense that he would keep it going. It may just be that he didn't have you guys designing and developing it. I mean, that could be the problem.
It might be. I don't know. I don't know what happened. But for whatever reason, the sun did set on that site. And there you go.
Yeah, it's interesting because definitely another path you might have gone would be just to keep Cork going forever. And
yeah.
You could be. And it would be like food spotting or something. It would be immensely popular and you could live on that.
Yeah, and at the time...
At the time, no, and now, maybe yes.
Yeah, now probably
if Dribbble
yes.
didn't exist, and if 5x5 didn't exist, if you had just started Corked and gotten to the same level of success, you might have said, you know what, let's just keep doing this. This is pretty fun.
Yeah.
And how did... What is Playgrounder?
I don't even run that anymore. Playgrounder was a site... I was working with a friend of mine who runs Uncrate. Uncrate.com right. is... Essentially, it's like cool stuff for men, basically. Or, you know, for their spouses who want to buy them cool things. And he's been doing this site for a very, very long time. I don't know if it's been 10 years or not, but it's been a very long time, very successful site. He'd spun off like an Uncrate for women, and then that sold. And, of course, I had this kid, and I'm like, man, you've got to do like an Uncrate for kids. He's like, oh, I don't have time. I'm running Uncrate. I don't have time to do it. But... You know, if this was something you wanted to develop and you could do pretty much all the work, you know, with a little bit of help from me,
including the content development.
Yeah.
Because I mean, there's one thing to, you know, figuring out the user experience and coding the back end and all that stuff. But then there's the whole other problem of content, you know, content production, governance. I mean, not production, but just like the constant creation of content and editorial control and all that. How do you do that? Who's doing that?
I did that. I mean, I got help from the Uncreate guy, especially at first, kind of organizing it. But I did all of that, and it was a lot of work. I mean, I knew exactly.
My kid likes this. My kid likes that. My kid like. But then you get tired. Like, here's another toy my kid likes.
Yeah.
Age. My kid's age.
Yes.
Filed under stuff my kid likes.
Right.
How do you do that as just one writer?
Well, what I was doing was I was always going through, and of course, like I said, you know, the Uncreate guys, they're always going through looking at everything all the time. So periodically they'd say, oh, here's something, but it was a lot of work. I was every day browsing and saying, oh, this toy looks good. Oh, this toy looks good. And it was really, for me at first, a lot of fun. And then very quickly, mind-numbingly boring and dull. And, you know, then you start to get like millions of emails from people who really, really want their toy to be listed on the site. They don't want to pay. They're not talking about sponsored posts, but they're saying, you should check out this line of toys.
Sure.
And, you know, and that was great too. That was a nice way to find out things, but it just, it very quickly became an overwhelming amount of work. I hired a woman, actually she's a stay-at-home mom who had kids herself, and she was writing the content and did an amazing job writing the content, and she was just so good. And what really I think made the site great was her writing on it. I mean, obviously the designer, Tom Carmody, did a great job doing the design, but it was really, I think, her content that made it great. But it grew and it got to a certain point, and then despite all of my attempts to make it more popular than it was, it just sort of stayed where it was. And I was always shocked by this. I was like, of all the people I know who might like to go to like a wine social site, like all of those people have kids and are always buying stuff for their kid. And people would tell me, oh, I love Playground, or I go there every day. It's great. But I don't know. It didn't resonate with people the way that I had hoped it would. And
it's still up and it's still got plenty of content. What's going on?
I don't know when the last time any new content was there, but I basically, you know, yeah, look at that. I still have my little backpack page where I had was saving links all the time. Yeah, I think that top post that's on there has been there for like a year.
The secret you said?
Yeah, it's been there for like 2 years. But
that's weird. Why wouldn't this be? Well, why couldn't you like? I mean, I could see a site like this making some kind of deal with Amazon or some other. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, we had affiliate money, but you know, yeah, the advertising money that we were getting for it was really small. And the affiliate money that we were getting from it was relatively small, and it wasn't growing despite what we could do. So I sort of, you know, I had been working on it with the Uncreate guys, and they said, well, we'll sort of bring it back in. And they did continue to update it for a while after I wasn't involved anymore. But I learned a whole lot doing that. I learned so much about what it's like to do, or to be at least in charge of managing that kind of daily content that's reliant upon links, that's reliant upon traffic, that's reliant upon great content and great design, doing lots of, you know, advertising deals, sponsor deal, all of it. I learned so much through what you could term a failed business, a failed idea.
So
that it was very valuable to me.
Yeah, it sounds like Playgrounder, in a way, helped pave the way for 5x5, which is a very successful content business, because you still have the same demands of daily content, lots of daily content. Now it has to be produced and it's audio. You know, I mean, text you can kind of get away with like 100 words and a link. And with audio, you know, with a podcast, you got, you know, 50 minutes worth of stuff you got to create over and over again. But you have to sell ads or find some other means of sponsoring it. And it sounds like you learned all those skills there.
Now, I definitely learned a lot of them there. If I, you know, if I had one thing to kind of take away from that, is that, yeah, I learned a lot of things that you could do wrong while you're there.
When did you start 5x5, and what was your initial thinking about what belonged on the network, and what, you know, how, you know, what kind of shows you wanted? What was the impetus for this?
Well, I always wanted to do radio. That was my goal when I, ever since I was a kid, you know, it was always, talk radio was always something that I had loved doing my whole life. There's even pictures of me, like, with, you know, my dad had like a ham radio set up, and maybe that was a spark to it.
Wow.
But you know, it my whole life, ever since I was a little kid, I love talk radio. I wanted to do it. Like, I would have a little tiny little Walkman radio in my jacket pocket, and I would fish a speaker, you know, a little headphone up through the jacket up into my ear and listen to it in class and like junior high. I mean, I was really into that kind of stuff, and I always had been. So naturally, I was a radio TV major in college. And the more I learned about the business, the more I've talked to actually people who within that industry were considered very successful, the more that I learned that, and I believe it's still true, but that at least at the time, and we're talking about like the early 90s, that it was an awful, awful business to be in. It was filled with stress and uncertainty, low pay, terrible hours, constant having to move from one part of the country to another to find work at stations. And it wasn't, and I don't believe is a good business to be in. I'm talking about like traditional terrestrial radio. And every time that I would talk to these people, they would say, well, like, what do you do? What would you do? And I would say, well, you know, like I'm a writer and I'm really good at computers. I've been doing computers since I was a kid. And they're like, well, if you're good at computers, why would you do that? Like, to them, it was like they didn't understand. Like, if they were good at computers, they wouldn't be doing this. Why would you do this?
It wasn't a passion for them, even though they were in the business.
Yeah, they had become so cynical. All of them, so cynical and jaded. Even wow. The ones that were successful were like the path to get here. And we're talking about like moderately successful talk show hosts in Orlando, Florida. I'm not even talking about the big ones in New York, who it's even harder to break into. You know, I'm talking about like these are people who worked 20 or 30 years to be like a talk show host in Central Florida, you know, which is not a big market. And they're like, if, you know, and so I started thinking about, you know, I can write, I've been writing, you know, forever. I really like that. And it's something I've always been very good at. And, you know, this computer stuff, maybe something will happen there in the future. So I just changed my major, and I said, well, you know, I have a limited amount of time and budget left to be in college. I could do the tech writing major, you know, basically get an English degree. I could do that. And so I kind of was doing like a minor in computer science, and until the money ran out. So, I basically finished with a, you know, degree in writing, and never actually did any writing as a part of my professional career. It was always just enjoyment, writing for enjoyment. But I went right into computers and doing software development, doing, you know, IT stuff. And that's what I did for, you know, 10 or 15 years before I found my way back to doing what I always wanted to do.
That's funny. That's really funny. I when I was in college, I wrote novels. I wanted to be a writer, and it's funny. And I tried to get my stuff published and couldn't. It's funny that I ended up, you know, at least part of my business being a publisher. I mean, funny and not funny, kind of obvious.
Yeah.
Is that picture of you as a kid?
You've seen that picture?
No, I haven't. I was going to ask if you could put that on. Is that somewhere on the web?
Yeah. Yeah, you can put that out there.
Can we put that link on the sure. the page for this show?
Yeah.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, it's me sitting in front of probably circa 1975 or 6, maybe. Me sitting in front of my dad's whole ham radio, which doesn't look all... I'm wearing basically the same headset. There's no mic, because the ham radio back then, it was all Morse code stuff. But the idea
Morse
of like...
Morse code?
Yeah, Morse code.
You knew Morse code?
No, I didn't. I didn't know anything more than a couple... like how to spell my name in Morse code.
Okay, but so you already were exposed as a kid to code and binary code.
I guess you could say right. that. I guess you could say it. But the idea that we were sitting there up in our little like, you know, spare attic bedroom or whatever, and that we were broadcasting out, and there were people not just like in the town nearby, but anywhere in maybe the whole world. You know, we'd get signals from people in the United Kingdom. We'd get from everywhere, from all across the states. You'd get this ham radio signal, and people would be like, "Oh, I'm in wherever." And I just thought communicating that way was fascinating. But the idea of the broadcasting part of it which is super cool to me at the time.
This is really interesting. You're making me remember, you know, I had an imaginary TV station. We didn't have TV when I was a kid. And then the first time I saw it was when my parents whisked me to an aunt's house when my brother was being born. My dad took my mom to the hospital and dropped me off at Aunt Lolly's, and she had a TV. And I was fascinated with that and had an imaginary TV channel in my head for like 10 years after that. And I remember my dad always had these reel-to-reel recorders, and he would record our like childish, you know, like my brother and me having a piano recital when we were little kids on like Memorial Day. And I was just really fascinated by all that, you know, the romance of technology and the way it captures some part of your human experience. And then the fact that you can push that to people. It's kind of the opposite of, I mean, we're doing, me by publishing a magazine and our books, and you by publishing podcasts, we're doing the opposite of what everyone says the internet is about.
Right.
Everyone says the internet is about a conversation. It's not, you know, it's not about, I'm an expert creating this content for you to enjoy, just like the people who make Mad Men are, you know, it's even more punk rock than punk rock. It's like everyone's in the band. The whole audience comes and they all get a guitar.
Yeah.
But we're sort of using, that's interesting. We're very early adopters of internet technology and both, you know, did a bunch of stuff early on and we're both sort of using it in old fashioned ways. The problem for content people, right, is that you have to keep making content. If you make something like Facebook, the users make the content and they're happy with it, right? Everyone on Facebook loves their own Facebook page. It's like everyone loves the smell of their own farts, you know? But if you're making content, like, you have to find people to run shows. You have to listen to all the shows and make sure they don't suck, make sure they're good, they're not wandering off course. How do you direct the people when you have a, I'll say David Sparks because I can pronounce his name without it. I'm not sure some of the people, because I haven't heard their names pronounced. I don't want to say them and, you know, get it wrong.
Right.
Like Jeremy, whose last name starts with an F. I don't want to accidentally get that wrong.
Right.
But, how much of directing is picking the right actor? How much of it is telling the actor how to act? How much of this, the success of your network, do you think, and the coherence of it from show to show is you telling people what, you know, here are my guidelines, and how much of it is just these people are brilliant and you just let them go?
I think it's mostly the latter. I think it's mostly, you know, people who, my goal for 5x5, there were kind of two goals for it. One is the obviously, you know, I need a way to make money. I need a way to make a living. So
sure.
If I can have a business that lets me do something that I love and get paid for it, that's a huge win. But my goal for 5x5 is, I could have done that. I mean, when I started 5x5, it was as a place to bring together shows I was already doing. I already had a few different shows, but they had their own websites. They were all over the place, and every time I wanted to launch a new show, I had to register a new domain. I had to set up the software on it. I had to publish it. They weren't all. And I said, you know, this doesn't make sense. Why, if I'm doing three different or whatever it was at the time, three or four different shows, why are they living in separate places? That doesn't make sense. I have to maintain them all separately, update them all separately. If I bring them all together, keep the show names, but bring them all together under this umbrella, then it makes perfect sense that people could find them more easily, and maybe that'll be a more than the sum of its parts kind of thing. So I brought them together, and then in doing that, you know, one of the shows, the interview show that I did, the very first episode of the interview show that I did, was, of course, with you, and discussion came out of that, and that led to the starting of this show, and that's how a lot of the shows started, is that I would have someone on as a guest, and I would say, man, that was a great... Nothing against the people who I didn't start shows with, because who knows, maybe they would have been great shows as well, and maybe they still will be. But some of the people, when I would talk to them after, I'd say, man, you know, a show might be nice to do out of this. If they said yes, we might talk about it. Maybe a show would be developed out of it. And so a lot of the shows kind of came out of those, what I felt, and I believe the listeners felt, were these really great, amazing discussions that I was having with people, whether it was on the pipeline or the conversation, two different shows I had. And it, those things led to the development of other shows. But obviously, I was doing those shows with people who I admired, who I loved, who I thought, wow, I could absolutely talk to you, you know, every week for an hour or so. And that led to potentially, you know, a whole series of shows, which all lived under this thing. So to go back to your question, I mean,
I had a question.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I don't get as much time as I'd really like to help people whose shows I'm not on, to help them. And that's part of the role, one of the roles that I really want to somehow over time move more into is a role where right. I can spend time instead of doing 6-8 shows a week. I can be helping people produce their shows and make them better. I could spend, for example, with you doing, I'd love to be more of an asset or more of a resource to you or to anybody who's here who needs it, because this brings us to my second goal for 5x5, the big goal, which is to make it a platform where people can, who have an idea to do a show, they can show up, they can be here for an hour, they can be awesome for an hour, and they don't have to do anything else. They could just hit a record button, maybe hit a streaming button, and even that I'd like to eventually do for people as well once we're better set up with like a studio. But
you mean like public access? You want to be sort of a
not public access, because
anyone could come?
No, not anybody could come. Certainly the people that are going to do shows, but that these people, talented people with great ideas, can come to us and we could say, yes, we will do this show. And work on it, produce it with them, do all of the stuff that's involved, hosting, artwork, production, you name it. We do all of that. And then they have a microphone, they sit down, they hit a button. An hour later, they've recorded a show, they get it to us, and then we do all of the work, all of the editing, that's all the production, everything.
That's kind of what how you and I are working now.
Exactly.
I record, and then I send it to Jim, and I let you know I've done it. And that's it. That, you know, my,
you walk
my
away, you go back and you know, kick your feet up and read some comic books.
I'm like, my job is kind of like that of a writer on a magazine who doesn't have to art direct and produce and get photo permissions and all that other stuff. There's other people who do that. The writer just has to write a great article. Right. And so that's what your hosts have to do. They have to hopefully do a good show.
Yeah. Show up and do a great show. And that's how I want it. And I want to be able to do that on a much bigger scale, because this, you know, people would say, oh, well, you know, Dan, your business doesn't scale. Well, it doesn't scale if I'm doing like all of the different shows, obviously. Right. But that's never been my goal. My goal was right. always to, you know, expand the network and do, you know, we have shows about tech. We have shows about the web. You know, we have a sports show. We have, you know, shows that are kind of more in the, or the new shows coming out as well that are focusing on different things. I want to keep expanding that, and yeah, I don't.
You don't want another Playgrounder.
Well, definitely not. And I want very much to have shows that, obviously, the focus is always. I don't want to say always, but my focus is always a bit on the tech or the geek side. But the intersection of the tech or the geek side and X, you know. So the sports show is the intersection of geeks and tech, and I feel like, you know, that kind of thing.
Your show is.
Yeah, tech and like diet and paleo and cult. So it's like the culture and technology where those things meet. That's where I think a lot of really interesting discussion can happen. So that's
like a food show with Jason Snell, not with of Macworld, not with sure. a food show with somebody who happens to cook.
Well, no, somebody who happens to cook could come in, but that person, you know, a perfect example would be Alton Brown. I'm a huge Alton Brown fan. I think he's great. And he is absolutely at the intersection of geek and food, you know, of, you know, tech and food. That's him. I mean, all over. He's a super geeky guy in the best way that you could possibly interpret that. And he would, if we were going to do a show about food and he wanted to do one, he would be like, in my mind, that's the guy who should do the show on Five, because he's a bit geeky and he talks about food. And that's sort of the vision that I have. You know, in my mind, 5x5, I've always, the goal for it was to be, you know, like an NPR for geeks. You know, that there's the NPR that you hear on the radio, and then if you happen to be a geek, your NPR is 5x5.
That is a wonderful goal. Let me ask you a question. Do you ever, since talk is your job, do you ever get home and your wife says, hi, honey, and you're like, I, no talk. I've been talking all day. For Pete's sake, just let me sit here with my mouth shut.
Definitely. And of course, that's, you know, that can be frustrating for her because the only people that she has to talk to are, you know, the age of four and younger. And, you know, despite what you may have heard, they don't always care about the same things that grownups care about. Right. But, you know, I mean, there's always the issue of the work-life balance. There's always the question of, you know, of it. But at the same time, like, talking to my wife is very different from talking, you know, from doing it, talking about some news story about Apple or, you know, something like that. So it's still a different kind of conversation, but oh man, right. there's definitely been long days where I've done a whole bunch of shows like today, including this one. I think I'm doing like probably 4 or 5 hours of shows where afterwards I'm like, I don't feel like I need to talk to anybody right now.
No. Right. Your two-year-old's like, forming complete sentences and you're like, whatever.
Yeah.
That's nice, honey.
Yeah. Go play with your toys.
Call John Gruber's kid. Tell him. How do you maintain life-work balance?
You know, it's, I don't know that I do. I mean, the implication when you say balance is that you feel that equal weight is being put on each of those different things.
No, just that you feel comfortable and your family feels comfortable, that the people who matter to you in your life aren't getting shortchanged, whatever that means to them and you.
Right.
And that you're taking care of your health, whatever that, I mean, you know, it doesn't mean that if you do 4 hours of work, you have to do 4 hours of like push-ups and drawing with your kids. It doesn't mean that.
Right.
That would be hard to do, but that somehow that everybody feels taken care of, that there's harmony in, you know, in the family, and there's, you know, that the work isn't causing stress in the family, that the family isn't causing stress in the work. I mean, because I think, you know, that can be difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear from somebody. Maybe you can tell me how to keep that from happening. I haven't figured it out. I mean, okay. I think the idea is you go into each situation as fresh and as new as you possibly can. And you try not to bring whatever stress or tension
right.
that happened in whatever the situation was, whether it was home or whether it was work, you try not to carry that over. So if you're stressed out at work, you don't want to bring that into your family if you can, but the same is true. You know, your kid goes berserk because he's four, you know, and then you've got to go do a show for an hour. Like you can't bring that over because then the show would suck. So, you know, for me, I think work-life balance just means doing the best you can possibly do to not let the stress or anxiety or frustration from one that might come naturally as just part of doing your job bleed into the other as much as you can possibly avoid it.
So it sounds like you're talking about being present for whatever situation you're in.
Right.
And having some kind of activity. I know you have a meditation practice, that or working out or playing the guitar or something that blows off steam in between, like kind of like what they say, Starbucks is the third place, having like a third activity besides work and family where you can blow off steam or whatever so that you're able to be fresh in work and you're able to be fresh for your family. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that absolutely makes total sense.
And what is a Jewish Buddhist doing in Austin?
Well, you know, you could say what was a Jewish Buddhist doing in Orlando?
True.
Actually, here I'm probably not that unique, and on those two regards, you know, we had been in Central Florida for a long time because.
How did you get there? Is that where you're from?
I'm from Philadelphia. Okay. We moved when I was like I think early teens or preteen time period. We moved to South Florida. We moved there because my mom was a teacher at a school up in Philadelphia, and there was some kind of big strike that went on and lasted for a very, very long time. Even as a kid, things that seem long, this was, I don't know if it was a whole year, but it was months or a very long time. Again, my mom, single mom, she's like teaching high school. We did not have a lot of money. So after, you know, not teachers all being on strike for this long period of time, you know, she was working in like a clothing store in a bad part of like downtown Philadelphia to pay the rent. And at some point, my grandparents, who have, of course, lived in Boca. I mean, of course, they lived in Boca. They said, you know what? Like, you should consider moving to Florida. It's always, you know, beautiful here. You know, they're, you don't have the awful winters. You don't have to drive on the ice. And there's plenty of, it's growing like crazy here. There's plenty of jobs. There's plenty of places you could work, you could teach, etc. And they were in South Florida, and my aunt and uncle were in South Florida. So I said, okay, we're going to move to South Florida. So we moved to South Florida, and I lived there. I did not like it. And when college came around, my grandparents had put, they'd done this thing called a prepaid college plan. You ever heard of this? Basically, no. They paid in, you know, when I was born in, or in sometime in the early 70s, or whenever it was that they moved to Florida, they basically put money into this prepaid college plan. So they bought me 4 years of college at like 1970s prices.
Unbelievable.
So that when I was finally ready to go to college in 1990, if I went to a Florida school, I was going to go at 1970s prices, not at 1990 prices.
But you had to go in Florida.
Had to go in Florida, had to go to a Florida school to do that. My grades were, although my ACT score was a 32, or 31, 32.
I don't know what that means.
It's very good.
They didn't have that when I was in school.
Yeah, so this was maybe a new thing. I don't know.
I think we just had the dunking stool.
My SATs, not great, but ACTs, I was really great. But my grades were like at barely average. I mean, I did not do well in school. I did not enjoy school.
Because you had the Walkman in your ear.
That's probably half of it. And it was, you know, I was not very interested in school. So, I mean, my GPA was probably like a 3.1 or something, which is okay. It wasn't awful, but it wasn't like I wasn't getting scholarship offers from wherever. So my choice was basically like pick a school in Florida. And I had visited a friend of mine who was, this is boring.
He said my choice was,
yeah,
as if there was going to be a choice.
Yeah. A buddy of mine had gone to the Nuke School in the Navy in Orlando. And I'd been back and forth there a number of times to visit him. And I thought it was a pretty cool town. It was far enough away from South Florida that like nobody could pay me a surprise visit, but I could still get down there if I wanted to go down there for a holiday weekend or something without having to get on a flight or spend an entire day driving. I could eat some breakfast, get in the car, and by lunchtime I was down there. So, you know, and it just, there were a lot of other reasons that came together. So I went to UCF down there, and then I was in Central Florida. When I met my wife in an English class, obviously we weren't married yet, but we just, for whatever dumb reason, we decided to stay in Orlando, and we kept staying. And then we lived in North Carolina for a while, and we wound up coming back, started our family. And then we're like, all right, we can really go where we want now. And where should that be? So we visited a lot of places here in Austin. We had friends in, this is boring to people, but I'll finish it. We knew a lot
of, what makes you say that?
I don't know. We knew a lot of people in Austin. I'd worked for a company where there were developers here. So I'd come out here, a couple times to stay with those friends that I'd made. And, my brother-in-law lived here. We loved it here.
Austin's fantastic.
So we moved. So that's it. We just said,
the food, the music,
everything. It's great here. It's a paradise.
The culture.
Yeah. It's like paradise really for raising a family here is great. Being young and single. And there's plenty of people who, yeah, retire here as well.
There's a huge accessibility community, huge internet community. There's South by Southwest every year.
Yep.
And all the activity, that the year-long activity that promotes. There's all the tech startups. There was Gowalla.
Yep.
I still miss Gowalla.
I do too.
It's nuts.
Is nuts.
Foursquare is awesome, it's weird. This will sound so sick, but it's like breaking up with someone and then going on dates with really nice people who are fun and sexy and smart and everything, but they're not the person you were with. And right. It's like that scene in Annie Hall where he tries to boil the lobster with someone else and
right.
She's not.
It's not
Annie
the
Hall.
Same. It's not as fun. It's never as fun.
He's trying to recreate an experience which you can't do in life,
right.
Which is, that. There are whole religions based on the fact that you can't do that. But and that's really what that movie's about in a way.
Right.
I always feel, I think we're starting to run out of time, but I always feel like a real connection with you when I talk with you. And you're a really interesting guy. I've had a lot of amazing experiences. And you feel, it feels to me like you live your life authentically and kind of transparently out there. And I appreciate that. I think a lot of your listeners appreciate that. And so
it's very nice of you to say. Thanks.
I just want to thank you for today and for our little talk. And if no one knows why I'm doing this and they didn't tune in because they're interested in Dan Benjamin, how could they find out? But now they are, having heard you. Obviously, there's benjamin.org/Dan for your bio.
Right. I mean, 5x5, that's you know.
That's where, that's your bread and butter.
That's it. Yeah, 5x5.tv, and you can.
Actually, it wouldn't be bread and butter for you.
Right, it would just be butter, because I don't eat the
butter
bread. Yeah, and gluten. Yeah, I can eat as much butter as I want. Take a little pat of butter, a little spoonful of coconut oil as a snack. Sure.
I have to talk to you more about that too, and a lot of other things. So I'm sure we'll do this again. But for now, thank you for co-founding the Big Web Show with me. Thank you for coming on as today's guest, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Anytime, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.